Surprise, surprise, Sergeant. Gamma pile.
Hello, welcome to Not an Audiophile, the podcast. This is episode one, season one. Today, to kick things off, as we are based in Australia, we thought we'd interview perhaps one of Australia's best known and perhaps most loved, almost certainly most loved, a loudspeaker designers, Mr. Brad Serhan. So you started Orpheus in 1980, I'm going to say 84, yeah, 84.
Yeah.
On a whim.
It was, I suppose, on a whim in that I started, okay, it goes back to 1980 when I did my, I think I constructed or designed my, well, I wouldn't put it, call, well, I call it designed. Sort of design,
yeah.
1980, and I remember doing a whole lot of design work on it with my limited knowledge, and it was a three-way, and I was
it was a three-way, it. So you thought you'd it was a three-way. Start at the top.
Yeah, and I was using a Peerless mid-range, Papercone mid-range, which was used in the Gale. 401s.
Well, that seems like a good place to start.
And a Magnavox 8MV, which was an 830 paper cone,
An Australian local, design. Local product?
Yep. And at that stage, I might have been using, I can't remember if it was a Sees H21 or it was a Phillips tweeter, an old Phillips tweeter.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, the upshot of that was, the reason I'm mentioning it is that I can remember assembling it to listen to it.
Yes.
To do the final listing, you know, putting the crossover inside rather than that being on the outside. And it was December the 7th, I think. It was the day that John Lennon was killed.
Oh, wow. Crikey. All right. Yeah, well, I know where I was. Yeah.
Was it December? Right. December the 7th? Something like that, 1980. And I remember doing the work and it came on, came over the radio. So that was a bit of a shock. And then that was sort of, I suppose, the start of me attempting to design loudspeakers and then building from there.
What were your thoughts when you... So you had the three-way running, sounding quite good, with the crossover on the outside. So when you, so really you're mentioning of putting it on the inside, you'd already heard the loudspeaker. It's more the case that it lined up with the unfortunate news, but
yes,
a bit worse than unfortunate, but you know, how did it sound? I mean, a three-way is a pretty tricky place to start.
Hey mate, it's 44 years ago, so...
Yeah, but did it sound... were you impressed? Forget how...
Okay, forget the time. That's bullshit, because in a sense, at the time, I had a pair of Kef 104 ABs.
Yep.
I was enamored with a pair of Celef Mini Pros and Stuart Tyler's, you know, Stuart Tyler's designs. I really liked the sound of those, but couldn't afford them.
Yes.
I could afford the Kefs because I knew the distributor of... the Sloss Brothers, I think they were, that distributed the Kef 104s and the Kef brand.
Yep, at the time.
So I had the 104 ABs at the time with a Riga, not a Riga, a Lin Sondek combination with a, oh shit, I think it was a Harman Kardon 505, Matty Atolla design amp with low negative feedback, apparently. So I had that combination, and so I had a reference in the 104 AB. So I was attempting to
replicate,
improve
to some
on.
Oh, improve. Oh, okay. So you're going to improve upon the 104s.
Oh, I mean, whether I did, that's debatable. And it's so subjective, as we know. And one has to be careful stuff that's produced from your own loins. You tend to be a little biased, maybe.
Can't. Well, you know, you could. It's actually a skill, I think, is to listen with an open ear or open head or an yeah. open mind, and be. Although I always find it how should I put it? You put your reference back. You're a little bit in love with your own product for a second, and then you put your, in this case, the 104s back on, and you go, a little bit more work to do.
And it might, that possibly might have been the case because
I'm not saying it was the case in your case, but certainly
no. I can remember the room I was in, and you know, listening to, and comparing it the two, and trying to. I mean, part of what we do as I suppose we call ourselves designers, loudspeaker designers, is hopefully having some sort of oral memory, although that might be debatable, having some memory of what something sounds like and then being able to hearing live music and then being able to, in your mind's ear, go, I think this is how I perceive it should sound. So what I'm attempting to say is I think from memory that I think it had some hallmarks of promise. That might be a better way of putting it.
Well, I mean, those ingredients were pretty damn good. I mean, you know, the Gales, people still get excited about some of the aspects of the performance of that loudspeaker.
Remember, the 401 with the, or there was the silver cap version.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
then there was the timber one. And a dear mate of mine, Richard Cowan, who was one of my hi-fi mentors in a sense, he purchased the Lynn Sondek. He went to Nick Borowski's River in a Hi-Fi, and all Lynn, Lynn name stuff, and they were proselytizing in the nicest possible way the Lynn name philosophy, and we all got inculcated to some extent about timing and all that sort of thing. So Nick was a bit of a maverick in one sense, a Hi-Fi maverick. He loved Nick Borowski, who was a great character, wonderful deep radio voice, a bit like yours, Andrew, actually.
Oh, yes.
He when you went in there with Nick Borowski, he had this wonderful rich tone. I think he had an English background, a good old-fashioned pomp, and he would sort of mesmerize you, the mesmers, with these sort of dulcet tones. Mellifluous is another word I'd use, and he'd start to succumb to the Lynn name philosophy. Well, Dick bought the turntable, an FR7. No, Dynavector Tone-Arm, this whacking great old thing with an FR7 Fidelity Research FR7 cartridge. With, he purchased an ME, I think Dick bought the ME75 Australian Design Amplifier by Peter Stein.
Yes.
Over the Western Australian Design HSA Amplifier, which he thought, oh, good Lord, shock horror, he preferred to the then name stuff.
Wow.
So, and then he went for the Gale 401. So,
yeah.
I why am I telling you this? Well, we're just having a discussion, but that's why I was listening to through the auspices of my good dear friend Dick Cowan. I used to go around with him listening to these different pieces of equipment as he was hunting for this stuff.
Yes,
I went to university with him, and he was sort of had a bit of money because he had worked in a part time job, so he's determined to get himself a decent system. So I got to hear a lot of stuff. AMW, another favourite. AMW, another Australian design loudspeaker.
Yeah, I think it was AMW Brisbane.
You know what? You've got me there. I don't remember.
I think
remember. It
was. I think I knew one of the people who was either the A or the M or the W, in later life, because, I mean, that is a...
Great characters, apparently.
Oh, well, if it's who I'm thinking, he is quite a character.
Maybe not.
No, he's a great guy, interesting chats many years ago when he, I think, ultimately ended up, in wholesale or repping or something, and so we would talk crap about speaker design. But
Colin Waits, wasn't there Colin Waits? There was was the Colin Waits.
That's and I don't know, and I've just at the second I've forgotten the person in question's name, but he had some, and he may not have been one of the A or the M's or the W's, but he was closely aligned or something, or had a hand in
something. In it, an ear in it,
An ear in it.
But, yes, indeed.
But so you had all so you had a a good working reference for what.
Well, how do we, what I'm attempting to convey is that I had a whole lot of shops. Well, there were a whole lot of shops that I used to go around and listen to systems, and Dick, because he was in that mode of wanting to purchase something, we were viable for dealers to talk to, you know, 20, 23 year olds or 22 year olds. Yeah. And they, funnily enough, they took Dick seriously because he ended up purchasing stuff.
Yes.
So that sort of formed what I was starting to get a sense of what I liked and didn't like to those young ears. And I liked some of the select speakers by Stuart Tyler, who went on to do PROAC. I definitely liked, I did like the Gales. There was something really communicative about them, indeed, musical.
Yeah.
And the AMWs struck a chord because a dear mate of mine, Johnny Robb, who grew up in the same town as me in Musselbrook, he's known me since birth. Well, not consciously from birth, but he had access.
Yeah, I was going to say that's quite a coincidence that your mother's lined up sort of in a queue or something, and
like, well, brothers from another mother. but yeah, in the old Musselbrook Hospital up there, it's like, why do we survive birth? Let alone. Bloody hell.
How did anyone survive back then, really? Things were so
rough
and tumble. And
I don't want to give away any secrets here, Andrew. I might pause it so you can cut it out. But Dr. Hank Rutherford, who was the chief circumciser up there, he was renowned for nice and neat like a cleat, was the old saying. But I tell you, Johnny Robb and I survived that. Whatever sensitivity had downstairs, gone, but it elevated to a new height and stays to our ears. Let me tell you, old style. So Johnny Robb, he also was a music lover, but his dad had a share in Retrovision,
okay,
which was a store that had music.
An appliance store, refrigerated, yes.
Appliance to hi-fi. And they actually got in some reasonable gear. They could get access, and Johnny had a pretty reasonable system, even back in the sort of, you know, mid high school years. So he and I were passionate about that. John's still my dear mate in Sydney, and we still fiddle around with hi-fi together. But the point being that that history of audio went way back.
Well.
And also clearly. Now I'm going deeper in the darker past.
Yes, yes.
God, I've got to have wonderful amount of verbal diarrhea here. My dear great uncle, Bill Moore. Bill was he was the head technician for a company in Angel Place called British Imports or something, I think, in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
And they used to import Goodmans and quad valve and quad electrostatics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So when we used to pop down to Sydney and visit my relatives, my grand uncle Bill had quad 22, the valve amps and the electrostatic set up, and I used to hear that and was enamored with, you know, just
so you with the, yeah, so you know, you cheated to some degree. You were surrounded by multiple listening opportunities to what we now realize in hindsight was all fantastic equipment and highly regarded still today.
I was very lucky.
I mean, it's a cavalcade of salubrious hi-fi from the 60s and 70s that you've just...
A cornucopia of, using the C word, a cornucopia of flavours being sort of marinated in. Well, look, you know, I'm taking piss out of myself, really, but the thing is that... But it was the fact that that Dad used to play a lot of music and Harry Belafonte and lots of stuff, and that's... You know, you start to enjoy music that your parents are playing, and then the aspect of what made it sound good came, you know, in the teenage years, and started dabble. And thanks to sort of effectively Richard Cowan was a sort of a fellow that sort of, because he was on that quest to get a decent system, I got to listen to it a lot, and that formed my own particular bent or flavour, if you like,
mm.
which came out in the three-way, and that's why I went on with that off of that tangent that I was using the peerless mid-range with the chamber, sealed chamber behind it, the same as the Gales. So to capture some of that.
Yeah, which, I mean, was probably the key ingredient of the Gales to some degree, other than the, well, they're easy to get along with top end and the...
the twin paper.
Yeah, the seal. Yeah,
eights or seven.
Yeah, yes. Well, yeah, I was going to say eights and sealed box alignment, as I remember it, without actually checking the internet. So,
yeah.
Yeah, if we were talking about my listening history, it probably completely different products, except for the Lynn name bit, perhaps. But certainly, I guess it's those early experiences with quality equipment do shape your taste a little bit. You weren't exposed to, say, you know, the likes of, you know, say maybe an American style sort of Klipshorn JBL type thing with a Hafler amp or something, which or a Dynaco amp or whatever. And so, but I guess in Australia, which is where we are, folks, if you're wondering, you probably can't tell because of our international accents, but...
Mid-Pacific accent.
Mid-Pacific. I think that's actually a different accent, but... I lost my place a little bit now. I was thinking about the Mid-Pacific thing, but no, I mean,
you're,
yeah.
You're were suggesting that I wasn't immersed in the American.
No, I think this country was. Well, I think this country certainly favoured a UK sound, I think, generally. And the local products, of which there were many back then, really, of varying sizes, probably swung that way a little bit, I guess. And that, I mean, if there's such a thing as a UK sound, but I mean, you did mention sort of pace, rhythm and timing earlier, and I guess there was a bit of that, but there was as much religion perhaps as there was pace, rhythm and timing.
Yeah.
But you know, there was something in it. I mean, it was sort of some kind of marketing, really, I suppose, that just penetrated. Well, And there was, to use the cavalcade word again, there was a cavalcade of English magazines, I guess, praises of LP12s and Name 250s or whatever. But if they were out, then whatever the earlier ones were. And
but the magazines, the English press certainly did, certainly spoke about Pratt and, as it was, you know, pace, rhythm and timing, and spoke about those things that you need, that you should have, and if a product didn't have it, it'd go by the wayside. It could have been tonally nice and a pleasant experience. I remember the Celestian, what were they? That quite an advanced speaker, drive unit actually, they were using for the bass mid.
Yes.
An Aerolam cabinet, Aerolam.
SL 6000s or 600. SL6, which then in a chipboard box, SL600s in a... Aerolam, the honeycomb aluminium material, they lacked, I thought. I mean, I owned a pair once. I traded a pair.
You know better than me, mate.
Well, I just, they, for some reason, without that box making a noise, they seem to lack a bit of personality or something. But I don't know. There was a bit of that, bit of a lack of body and a bit of a sort of a, I don't know, a bit of nothing about them. But then maybe there was a bit of a Celestian thing there as well, because I haven't really ever found them to be completely to my taste. But before we go any further, I want to. It's time for an ad break. We've got to pay for this bullshit somehow. So we'll be right back with more of the Brad.
Tremendous. Yes, indeed. Well, I'll be welcoming you back as Richie Benno, so that'll make it easier for everyone to know when we're back in.
We look forward to that.
Thank you, sir.
Back in a sec, folks.
Delacorde loudspeakers. Designed and manufactured in Australia. In fact, manufactured in their own facility in Brisbane. Three different models, three different flavours, and all built up to a standard, not down to a price. On demonstration now, in hi-fi dealers across the country, and available also direct. Have a look at delacorde.com.au.
Yes, indeed, marvellous stuff. And welcome back to the MCG. It's Richie Benno here with my erstwhile friend, Andrew Hutchinson. And thanks for allowing me on the program. Go ahead, Andrew. Sorry.
It is an absolute
pleasure. Cut that out. Start again.
No, we'll just keep rolling.
Forge.
But in the break, the brief break, we did remind ourselves that there was American hi-fi in the local scene, and other. I mean, there was quite a bit of European stuff. I mean, there were, and I remember ads for dual turntables and I'm trying to think who it was, and I used to deal with them years ago. Might have been Fork. Yep. Yeah. And we sold those. We sold gazillions of those turntables. And when I was a child, and Torrens, of course, and was a bit of Telefunken, and what was those other kooky German electronics brands that were kind of cool looking. But I think the overriding kind of gear that sold in this country, certainly by the mid 70s, was Japanese electronics.
Yes,
supported in many cases by speakers that whose heritage lay in the United Kingdom. But you mentioned Klipsch, I mentioned Klipsch, but you mentioned an experience with those, and also ARs. And I think AR actually, I mean, I think, well, we never sold much in the way of ARs, but we sold other things like, you know, sort of, I must admit, they were slightly lowbrow products along the lines of Sue and Vega and Jensen and things like that.
Yeah,
which you know, I suppose we sniffed a bit at. But you know, hey, you know, that's what some people wanted. But tell me about the experience with the ARs. Although that was a recent experience, I think. But the Klipsch La Scalas from years ago.
Yeah, well, this goes way back. To 1980, Andrew, and that was, I was working at Douglas Hi-Fi in George Street in the city, and they had a service department upstairs, thanks to a fellow by the name of Reinhard Resch, and he employed me to work upstairs for his service department for Douglas. He was over at Artarmon. That this is all information that really is not important, but it gave. I was doing my uni course, and so I, part of a sandwich course, was doing this sort of work. So, I had an opportunity to go down into the store quite regularly to listen to gear, and they had a setup in their demo room of Klipsch La Scalas, with a Linsondic turntable with a Grace 707 arm. I can't remember the cartridge, and I. It might have been Crown amplifiers. I can't remember.
Well, okay.
It's irrelevant. But I'd been to listen to the Sunny Boys at the Trade Union Club, and a few evenings back, and then I had the opportunity to bung my LP down, the Sunny Boys album down, on the LP 12, and then far out that combination for my then youthful ears. It just sounded so close to what I heard in my, you know, a sense of the dynamics and the scale and the punch. Now, whether that was going to be great for classical music or brass music, I can't tell you because I can't remember. I did play that system a bit, but I can't remember really what it sounded like apart from that.
It would have had a similar punch and character, obviously, to a, well, I don't want to denigrate it by suggesting to horn-loaded front of house PA speakers, but I mean there is, you know, there's going to be a slightly similar sonic signature, I suppose, but a sweetened and more accurate, more polite version of perhaps what you heard at the pub.
Yeah, but what it did bring to the party, so to speak, or to the equation, was that it had the scale and dynamics.
Indeed.
High sensitivity, obviously, but it just punched. So it was visceral, and it immediately gave me that feeling that I was back at the concert, despite the limitations of a, you know, you're still not going to reproduce sound at level that a live band versus something bung on vinyl.
No.
I love my vinyl, but so it did convey the sense of scale and power, and it was memorable.
Well, clearly, because that's 100 million years ago, and you,
yeah,
you indeed remember it.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of is. So that's 40 odd years ago. It's interesting how the human brain works, isn't it? You know, that you can't remember what you did, literally, as people say, this morning. But I mean, I think that's partly youth and having been memorably impressed. And
discovery.
Discovery, indeed.
It's discovery. I think there's a certain amount of, oh, I didn't know sound could be like this.
And it was actually, as much as it was common in a way, there was lots of hi-fi stores, there was plenty of gear around, there was lots of gear being sold. The 80s was a great time to be in the hi-fi industry, but still a small percentage of the community at large would wander into such a shop or be exposed to such high-quality sound, do you think? I mean, that's the way I remember it. I still think it was it's kind of a niche interest at that serious end of the scale. Everyone had a stereo of some description, because what else were you going to do? I mean, it was, you know,
yeah.
I mean, there was. I mean, the great thing for the hi-fi business back then was that there was really literally nothing else to do. That you could ride your bike, drive your car if you were,
motorboat, maybe
a boat. You could get into cameras. You could get into hi-fi, obviously, and really, and women, of course, at some point. But what else were you going to do?
Or men, depending on.
Well, but back then, it's probably borderline illegal or something. I don't know. It's not something you mentioned in mixed company.
I think the first Mardi Gras was 1979.
Well, there you go. So Queensland at that stage, and perhaps still today, is 25 to 30 years behind the rest of the country. So,
I can say that as
a Queenslander. Yeah. Sometimes people will say, oh, yeah, you don't have daylight savings up there. You know, how far behind are you? And or if you say that to them, they quote usually 20 years, actually, but not the hour, of course, that there actually is a difference. But, we probably got distracted. There wasn't a lot to do, and music, I think, more than hi-fi, was probably a big part of people's life. You know?
No, you're right. I think you're right, Andrew. That the disposable income would go towards a house or a car and kids' education, maybe, and then really it was that was the high technology thing at the time, maybe.
And a colour TV for
colour TV and effectively. To give you an idea of what it was like in Sydney, I remember the number of shops in Sydney in the CBD. There was a gobsmacking amount of shops in that city area. In York Street alone, I think there were three within Magnetic Sound, Leisure Sound, and Quality Hi-Fi within 50 to 70 meters of each other.
Oh, I remember that.
And Leisure Sound. Yeah, and Leisure Sound, that's four.
I remember I remember walking around one city block on a visit in the early 80s, and there was definitely three shops in close succession, and I was impressed by things that I hadn't seen before, which of course is easy to believe, but there's all sorts of things on display that and each store had its own little, clearly as they do today, had its own personality, had its own kind of equipment. I suppose they were more in the city then and less in the suburbs, but then that was about the time that the suburban shops started appearing. Obviously Len Wallace probably not one of the first, but for me, it turned my head a little bit, because you had things like Meridian, which I had a bit of a crush on. So,
Meridian,
And
their active speakers.
Well, the active speakers were the thing, and it wasn't even necessarily the fact that they were active. It was I just liked that. Well, I was one of the first speakers with a narrow baffle and a deeper carcass. So
they looked pretty nice, actually.
I think so. I don't know whether it's real or not, but you sort of look back at it, feels like things change pretty quickly, in the sense that floor standing speakers, not that the Meridians were, they were stand mounts effectively, but the I'm just using floor standards as an example of today. You can go into a shop today and they're largely the same format they were 25 years ago, or maybe even 30. They're basically narrower baffle, deeper box. They're a certain height, somewhere between 900 and 1050 or something, and they, you know, that's what they are. Whereas 70s and 80s things, there was a lot of change. Obviously, we were going from a wider front, you know, from a shallower, wider box, probably because of, you know, bigger drivers, bigger base units, and moving towards that small drive unit, narrower box, and the Meridian were probably one of the earlier purveyors of that shape, I guess. And maybe that's why it caught my youthful eye. But, you know, but I don't know how they sounded, because I don't think Len turned them on for me, because as a 15-year-old wandering around Lane Cove, he probably thought I was a homeless child or something. And anyhow.
The thing is that I suppose I can't remember them either. I can remember them, but I can't remember the sound of them.
I have heard them, of course, in later life, because I've repaired quite a few pairs. And they sound quite nice. They do have that Meridian sound where they're quite clean, a little bit polite, quite nice. You know,
reserved,
slightly reserved, but
slightly reserved.
Indeed. So you were. What was your other American hi-fi experience, if there was one? And did it? And did it have a lasting impact? Or what was? Or what was the thing? I mean, the way you speak to me, it was really the Celefs, probably at the nub of.
I mean, that's a great question, and I normally say great question because it gives me time to think about an answer. So give me a second. That's a tremendous question, Andrew, and I clap my hands with joy that someone's finally asked me this question.
Well, I do think back, and I mean, an 8-inch two-way was a common design back then, and some of your earlier designs were that size. I guess it was an 8-inch two-way that you. There must have been an 8-inch two-way that you loved at some point, clearly your own products, which were excellent, but, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if we've ever mentioned Orpheus loudspeakers yet during this.
No. You might have mentioned it at the start.
Yeah, maybe I did.
Question.
I did.
You did. But I will answer the question because
far away.
I often don't answer questions. I meander first, give backstories, and then forget what the actual question was. We'll get there. Now, so the key thing was that in that sort of Dick Cowan quest to find a speaker to work with his Lynn Sondek and et cetera and the ME, we went to a lot of stores, and I got to, as I was saying, there was about 12 shops in the city. So the marvelous thing around, you could just walk
12
some Instrel Douglas Hi-Fi. There's one down Kent Street. There was the three
what
I think,
Kent Street Hi-Fi.
Yeah, there's Kent Street Hi-Fi, and there's also one in Castle Ray Street as well. Why am I talking
Castle
about
Ray
Hi-Fi
Street voice? Hi-Fi
original names. Sydney Australians like, you know, sort of this sort of beer, but Sydney Harbour Bridge, Sydney Opera House. There's nothing flamboyant.
No, that's not
simple.
Let's keep it. We want to know where the thing is geographically located based on its name.
So
and perhaps in a time before Google Maps, that did make it easier.
It did. There's some.
I wonder where the Sydney Harbour Bridge is. One would, you know, an American tourist was thinking to themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And as they were walking down Collins Street, but
in Melbourne, yeah, I got it. So basically, to answer that question, so when we were on that quest with Dick Cowan, I went into, it wasn't Kent. There was another guy, a bunch of guys who did Shaw cartridges, SME tone arms, and they had KEF 104 ABs and the Celef range.
Okay,
and I'll never, for some reason, I liked the sort of 7 or 8 inch design that were ubiquitous around then. And there was something in the way that speaker, whether it was the white, it's sort of this white cone, peerless white cone, paper cone with a C's H211 tweeter. There was something about the look, but then when the fella fired it up for us, it just engaged me. And I was never, yes, it'd be great to do a, to design a, you know, a big floor stander multi-way thing, which I sort of did initially in 1980. But when I heard this in 82, mm-hmm. I thought it surpassed the KEFs to my ears. Yet I bought the KEF 104 ABs because I could get them at wholesale because I was working at Douglas Hi-Fi in the service department, which meant I could get access to their stuff.
Yep.
So I couldn't afford to buy the Selefs.
Well, it didn't make it, – it. Yes, it put a slant towards the KEFs when you were buying them for 6% less the retail margin. Yes.
Whatever it was.
As it was back then, yeah.
Yeah, so look, basically, I quite like the KEFs. They're sort of very rich and warm, and they hugged you.
Lovely speaker.
And sort of voluptuous in a way. Mm. But that was the speaker I coveted, and I mean, it doesn't sound like very high aspirations, but the Selef Mini Pro was a cracky design, and that's what I think. It was sort of what I could actually, I thought I could reproduce as a in my early days at trying to tweak around with speakers. So that was the speaker that struck a chord. And then I then saw a review in the Hi-Fi News and Record Review, UK magazine, June 1982.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this review on it. And they were saying nice things about it.
On the, it's good to have... on the KEF?
Oh, no, on the Selef Mini Pro.
On the Selef, yeah.
And that your audience need someone to say, hey, you're thinking the right way. It's a pundit that knows more than you, supposedly. And I said, gee, they like it. Right, that's great. And then I saw the measurements. I think Martin Collins made the measurements, and he actually had the ability, or he actually measured them, obviously the tweeter and bass driver connected, but then he did it without one connected, the tweeter not connected, the bass not connected. Mm-hmm. I could see where the speaker was rolling off.
Ah.
I had a Neutrik chart recorder at the time. That's what I was using to measure my speakers with a microphone, of course. And I wanted to emulate that speaker, and I knew the bass driver was a Peerless, and I could purchase in Australia. I knew I could get the Seas tweeter. I actually went to Seas. Seas sold me a few.
Okay.
And,
So you'd almost say that's when the business started to a degree, if you're dealing with the drive unit manufacturers. Or more to the point, yes, they were dealing with you.
Yes, and they were willing to sort of, well, C's willing. I think I got the Peerless in Australia, and I'd already done a 6-inch 2-way, which didn't have a brand name.
Yep.
So that was a Magnavox 6-inch with the H211 tweeter. So I'd already sourced the C's tweeter.
Yes.
And then, geez, this is a long, boring story, but I'll persist. So I'll persist. For just pure historical purposes.
It's going to pop out the other side in a second. Keep going.
Yeah, keep working at it. The genesis of Orpheus. Just the gestation period's too long. But what happened was I thought, stuff it, I'm going to have a crack at designing it. So I tried to emulate, not knowing what crossover they were using, but I had to look at, okay, they're crossing over at approximately this frequency.
Could you see from the published bass and treble responses only, could you suss out the acoustic roll off, like the rate?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, yep.
And that gave me clues. And then, of course, I didn't have values, nor did I want to have values, Andrew. I basically wanted to. It was a homage.
That's right. You don't need them anyhow. Neither then nor now.
A homage to it. And then, not plagiarism, but just a homage. Yeah, okay, that's approximately where they cross it over, but I'm going to listen to it. And then I started to sort of course, I'm measuring it in different room surroundings, you know, probably nowhere near as accurately as Martin Collins in some sort of anechoic chamber or whatever.
Mm.
But it was I really just was determined to get it in the zone. And then I then started to manipulate the crossover. Once I sort of had it cross the over proxy, you know, was the cone cry? Was the bass driver hardening up? Was the tweeter quacking? All those things you have to look for, listen for
when you're
designing a two-way. Was it possible for the 8-inch or 7.5-inch Peerless driver to reach out to this H211 tweeter and vice versa? And could they Could there be a significant marriage between a melding of the two?
Mm.
And so that speaker I worked on in 83, but then I finally finished it off in 84, and that's when I started Orpheus Loudspeakers in 1984, 40 years ago.
Whew, we got there.
Oh,
Christ. That marriage of those two drive units in a, I'm presuming, approximately 2 cubic foot box was Model 1, effectively. What did you call it?
Well,
it
was known as the Orpheus Dolomite.
Uh-huh. And so I'm going to cut you off again. Orpheus Dolomite, obvious references to some kind of, I don't know, I'm no expert on Greek mythology or wherever the hell that comes from, but you could fill me in.
Dolomite being a mountain range in Italy, so...
Well, the Dolomites, But the Orpheus, a lot of your models seem to have a... Where's the Orpheus thing come from? When I say
Greek
thing,
mythology.
I mean, yeah, Greek mythology. Okay.
It's a thing. It's Greek mythology. And Orpheus was a beautiful musician. I can't remember my own story. Not my story. Orpheus. All I know is that Orpheus played a harp.
Yes.
When it came to harps, he could harp on note like nobody else. And his fingers are just, you know, delightfully touched. I mean, I'll stand corrected here because it's been a long time. Actually, I've got the narrative in a brochure. Hold on. Anyway,
let's
the upshot
go through
was
my old brochure file. Dig it out.
I can't find it. Anyway, so he was a beautiful, and the gods loved his music. They just loved his music. So I'll update you next time we chat about it. But the key thing, where I got Orpheus.
Actually, when I think about it, isn't really that many other models that you had that had anything to do with the Greek thing, was it? I mean, because
There was Minotaur.
Well, the Minotaur was the one that was,
Apollo.
So there was a few.
And the Dolomite was because the old man loved English cars and always wanted to get a Jaguar, could never afford one. So he would buy these, you know, he'd buy Holden, H.D. Holden. X2.
Now tell me you owned a Dolomite Triumph.
And then he effectively went on to get maybe it was a midlife crisis, he purchased a Dolomite Sprint.
Yes. Oh, Dolomite Sprint. Good car in its day kind of thing, you know.
Yeah. And it had overdrive in third and fourth.
Absolutely.
Quite unique. And double overhead cam.
Yeah, absolutely. Double overhead cam was the thing that I was going to mention. And I think twin side drives of some description, but I can't quite remember. But a friend did have one back in the day. And I remember he was in the band that I was involved with. And I wasn't playing an instrument, of course. I'm in the hi-fi industry. I'm incapable, but I was involved with the lighting and sound. And we had this at 2 o'clock in the morning one day. We finished, you know. Obviously, we'd had a couple of drinks, I guess. And I challenged him to a duel to the other side of town, which we undertook at great speed, proving that a Mazda RX-4 is very, very marginally faster than a Dolomite Sprint, but faster.
Did it handle it?
Faster nonetheless.
Did it handle as well as the Sprint?
There were no corners involved, so the Mazda was capable of winning, but... obviously the Dolomite was probably a handler compared with an RX-4. I mean, basically a tip truck is a handler compared with an RX-4, but... although I've been told tip truck's a term you're not meant to use anymore, any old people say that, so should we say some kind of earth-moving equipment that gets the dirt...
The earth moves, I like that.
Yes, anyhow.
So the Dolomite Sprint was the basis.
So there was, it was on your mind. Yeah, okay.
It was on my mind. I got to drive. I was allowed to drive it occasionally, and I just wanted to make sure it didn't have the reliability of the Dolomite Sprint. British Leyland.
It would be hard to replicate the.
The lack thereof. So the Dolomite was the first Orpheus model. Mm. And then after that, it sort of...
Well, there's some history, because I had no idea that it was related to perhaps the car, which, of course, is related to the mountain range, Dolomite,
yeah,
or however the Italians would like to pronounce it. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So...
So that's sort of, in a sense, the first model. And then there are other models that came after that.
You sold them mostly through dealers, and I guess in hindsight...
No, I didn't. Not initially, though.
No, is that right? That's kind of my next question. So how did the sales happen?
Well, it was the day. Those are the days when we had a thing called Trading Post.
Oh, okay, yeah, rightio.
So I mocked up a...
For those international listeners, it's a sort of a classified newspaper. There's no news stories in it. It's just ads.
Secondhand stuff, anything. Electronics, garbage, cameras, old cars.
Probably a good way to gain an insight is to watch The Castle.
Yeah, yes, that's it. Yeah, great movie. So I composed a... hopefully what I hoped or thought would be a compelling advertisement in there.
Have you got a copy of the ad, like it's in a... You got a clipping in a scrapbook somewhere? Or?
No, I wasn't that anal. I didn't chronicle that. But a friend of mine that bought a pair of Dolomites handed me back a whole lot of Minotaur, Dolomite and Apollo brochures. They're just classic A4 in various... light yellow, cream colours or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I did was I sort of just spoke about the enclosure. I've got it in front of me now. Just happenstances. I didn't have it for this particular podcast. It lobbed on the table
here. It's just always there.
Just to remind me where I've come from where I haven't gone. I mean, really, it hasn't changed much. Sorry, I'm getting shrill. So basically, I went on about the cabinets being rigidly constructed with special care paid to edge clamping technique, bracing is between place to sit panels and thereby raise the panel resonance, all that blah, blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
eliminating the influence of blah, 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 tar padding is strategic tacked and glued, and all that. And then I spoke about the drivers, the crossovers, being polymetallized polypropylene, solens, I think I was getting at the time. And what I was trying to do is say, what I was trying to convey was that you've got the marvellous English brands, which are much touted and well-deserved, no doubt, but we're doing it over here for a much cheaper price, more competitive price.
Mm.
And we have an Australian flavour, whatever that was. I just had the three model lineup, and I paid whatever it was every couple of weeks. And would you believe?
Yes.
Surprise, yeah. Sergeant. Gamma Pyle. I actually had some very interesting characters who wanted to listen to the speakers over to my place and we were back the classic backyard operation in the lounge room and I had some great characters come on over. There was one particular fellow and I thought we provided service for a few people, actually, because, for those who are lonely.
So it was sort of a multifaceted business, really.
Well, it was. It was back then. And there's one particular fellow who came to the door, very interested, listened to the speakers, and he said, "Do you have Frank Sinatra?" "Yes." "I've got a couple of albums here myself." "Oh, great. Bring them on in." And then I think he just came. It was like a library. I felt like we were an audio library, if you like. He came along to listen to some of my stuff and then had a cup of tea, a nice Vovo and a ginger nut. And
did he bring a small bag and a pillow? Oh, no, he left. Okay.
No, but I'm taking the piss. But in a sense, let's not mock those days. I think it made me realise the different types of characters that are involved in music, what they're wanting from their music. And sometimes... You were never going to get a sale. Some came over because they had the time to either put shit on Australian stuff, which is also fine, and in a pleasant polite way, because I did want them to choke on the ice bow.
They were in your home, so I guess they were toning down their disdain a little bit. But
yeah, that's right. That's a great way to describe it. Describing it anyway. So, but there were times I got sales, and I went out to various people's places with the speakers in tow, with speaker stands, and doing home demonstrations, and actually, you know, surprised. I actually got some sales, and one fella that I, this is a nice tale because he's still a dear friend today. A bloke called, there were two Trevor Wilsons, and there's the Trevor Wilson.
One would have thought one was enough, but no.
Oh, he's gorgeous. The ME Trevor Wilson, who represented Peter Stein's ME amplifiers.
There's that Trevor
true
Wilson,
stalwart of MEs. That technician Trevor.
Yes.
Who's a wonderful fellow, and there's another story there which I can tell you offline about Trevor. as in nothing licentious or lewd.
No, lewd.
More about the fact he was the first hi-fi shop I ever visited. I'll go off on a tangent. Trevor Wilson owned a hi-fi shop on Military Road, Cremorne or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
And I went in with a pair of my speakers with a prototype crossover on the outside so I could adjust it. And Trevor could have told me to piss off, but he was bored. He had plenty of, there was no customers in the shop. He said, "Oh, come in." Yeah. And he actually had a listen.
Right. So this is Trevor the Tech we're talking about.
So Trevor the Tech, Trevor.
ME Trevor, yeah.
ME Trevor. And he's a very direct sort of fellow.
That's a very polite way to... Yes, I mean, you have to love Trevor for his directness.
I love a direct Trevor. Call me old-fashioned. I mean, it's all out in the open. But what happens is when you see the flight of the ball, so to speak, in cricketing parlance, when you can see the flight, you can either block it or you can sort of step down the pitch and drive it, or you can step in the back foot and hook it. And that's what Trevor does. He gives you a clear sight of the ball. You know what's coming at you. Whereas other people are different. They disguise it. And they'll get you with a googly, and if I could bold, but there are a few dealers that did that to me in the nicest possible way. Upshot is that he gave me a chance, and he really liked the product, and he told me, he said, "Okay, the speaker," and he said, "Go away and get it dressed up properly, and I think you have something." So he gave me that. Said you just need someone.
So Trevor
to get
was
you to
yeah. Sleep. So he was early. Money on Orpheus, so that was.
He wasn't the first shop.
He
closed. He didn't actually. I think he either closed the shop or he was working for someone. I can't remember.
Okay.
But effectively, he gave me the wind in the sail. All these fucking metaphors. Nautical metaphor. So he gave me the wind in the sail to keep pushing, and then, but I was still doing the trading post stuff.
Okay.
And basically, the other Trevor I mentioned lived in Lilyfield, not far from me. And Trevor had been in audio a little bit as a sales rep. And he had a pair of those Kef, the modern, he had a bandpass woofer, the Kef 104 it was called. And it was a floor standing speaker. And he's using a bandpass woofer. I can't quite remember. But He was looking at buying those. Did he own a pair? But he got itchy feet, and he came over to my place because he was literally sort of 5 minutes drive away, and heard the Dolomites, screw in front panel, and he really liked them. So I took them over to his place in 1985, I think, and he purchased a pair.
Wow! Okay.
He still has them today.
Wow! Is that right?
Yeah.
They're a collectible.
But he was the guy that he was taking me around. He started the process of saying, "Brad, I'd like to help you get some hi-fi stores."
Okay.
And what he did was he managed to get me Sturman's Audio.
Wow.
In Sturman Electronics, as it was then, in Wollongong in 1990. And they have been along with them, Wallace Audio, our best store in terms of
continued
just amazing
support.
Character.
Yes.
It's continued support thanks to Trevor Wilson. So when you're doing it the way, and you've done it yourself with your speakers, when you're doing it at that where basically you're flogging stuff through trading posts, you build relationships with people. They're going on the journey with you, and I hate the word journey, but you start to sort of become, in a sense, friends, because you're sort of working with them to get the system right. I'd sometimes help them get equipment or whatever and help this. So those little pivotal moments sort of kept me going, getting sales through trading posts just long enough. I managed to sort of hop along or crawl along, making some money out of that. And then finally got into my first retail that I think was Music by Design, Matthew Bond from Tara Labs, Tara Labs speaker cables. He prior to starting Tara Labs, had a shop in Bondi Junction, and he listened to my speakers and took them on. And then Lem Wallace then also took them on in 87.
In 87, okay, yep.
Yep, and that was thanks to Ralph Waters from Richter.
Right.
Now, Ralph Waters from Richter Loudspeakers, or Richter Acoustics, he and I got to know each other, and we'd have muck around design days.
Muck around together. Design days. How does that work? What happened there?
Well,
beer was drunk or something. Would he have a beer or would he have something else? I don't know.
He might have a beer or
whatever
something was. That he found in the bushland. He would have a beer and I'd have a coffee and we'd either fall about laughing at our attempts to get something right. I mean, it was just sort of what we're doing is R&D, I suppose. But he's a very urbane, he's a character.
Character. So, well, I presume he's still a character. He certainly was.
He's always a character. And he's a dear mate, even though I haven't spoken for a while, but he's a dear mate. And we supported each other because we're both on the quest to try and establish our footprint, our sonic footprint in stores. And so he was at a different price point to me. He was a lower price at that stage. And so if he went to a store and didn't break through,
yes,
he would say, "Hey, Brad, visit these guys. I think they're after a more expensive speaker," or something like that.
Yeah.
And he went to Len's and then said, "Have a crack at Len. I think you should go there." So I went there and managed to get the Dolomites and Minotaurs in there through Doug, the wonderful Doug Isaacs, who got them, and then Len and Nigel. Mm-hmm. And then it started to fall from there. And then Ralph Waters, he ended up getting into Richter, into Len Wallace Audio, and they're still there now. And, Ralph did really well. In fact, Ralph was a mover and shaker, but that's another story. He was a great promoter, Ralph.
Well, I've got a notation here to bring Ralph up in a future recording, a future podcast, as I believe the kiddies are calling it today.
Podcast, or potties. We should chase Ralph up because he tells a great story. Great raconteur, Ralphie.
Yes, that would be good, and I think the audience would. Be very. I mean, there's a lot of love still for Richter. I mean, it's there's a lot of love for Orpheus still. It's just the difference is that Richter's still on the floor, even though it's not the kind of, it's not really the same product in any way that it was back then.
It's had to move with the times.
The reality
is,
yes, and because it's still a very sharply priced, very good value for money product.
Incredible.
And you can't do that while making cabinets in the outer suburbs of Sydney. So,
no, that's right. And Martin Gosnell, Doc Martin, he is a very, very bright, engaging fella. And Brian, of course, is a champion. He owns the Richter brand. And so it's still got the spirit of the original Orpheus.
Absolutely. They're pros, and in fact, it shows. I've been next door to them a couple of times, which is really annoying because obviously their product is much more sharply priced than ours. So, clearly ours performs, at a higher level. but the reality is they both sound great. And yet theirs is exceptionally sharply priced and great value. But I had little to do with Ralph back in the day, but he did visit me once at my store.
Oh, did he?
And he it was kind of hilarious, and he just sort of meandered in. I believe either in thongs or bare feet, and said, "Oh, do you want to? I'm Ralph Waters. Would you like?" He didn't have that accent. I can't actually quite think how he sounded, but
yeah, this is how he sounded. May I mimic him?
Please do.
Well, temp. It's been a while. And he goes, "Hey, Brad. Hey, Brad. Could you? What are you doing next week? Would you like to come down and do some design stuff?"
And
he used to cock his. Oh, it's just because we did a lot of. I'll stop. Keep going, Andrew.
Going. Now that you've done your very good impression, I think quite accurate, because it's certainly bringing back memories of that moment where he did come in very casual and. Asked whether I'd like to have a listen. And I said, yeah, absolutely, because, you know,
yeah.
I mean, I've got Brad Serhan stuff here, but, you know, he's like, yeah, that's so fucking good. And
he's a knob.
I think that's the exact words he used. Yeah, he's a knob.
Audio knob.
He's up himself. So he brings, and they sounded great. And of course, it was a different product to yours. It was... Yeah. Not a lot cheaper, but the floor standards was what he. There was a couple of different floor standards, and maybe a medium and a larger one, and or a small and a medium. I don't know, but they sounded good, and I had all sorts of things there that were pretty decent, and they compared very favorably, easy to listen to, no obvious engineering flaws whatsoever, and very good, well-rounded product, and we did sell a bit then, and then in later years sold quite a lot more, but under, you know, following ownership, of which that business has had, I think, maybe four or five owners over the years, and and actually most of them have carried the baton on pretty successfully. Oh, yeah, Brian
John Cornell,
yes,
and but what was the other fellow's name prior that Ken Dwyer.
Ken Dwyer had it.
Ken Dwyer?
John Faye.
And again, it was Doc Martin, or I like to call him Dr. Martin.
Oh, that's right. That's where he started.
Dr. Physics is Martin.
Yes.
There was a theme from Martin continuing the design. The baton was, sonic baton was handed on to him. And but look, the thing about Ralph is that you have to say they had sort of the V word, vigor, vim, verve. They were sort of, in a sense, a little like Ralph's personality. Cheeky.
Look, they're just good speakers. I mean, they were that, but they were charmers, and they made music, and
they made music. That's right.
And as did yours, absolutely, but in a probably slightly more revealing kind of way, I would say. But
and that gets down to my old theme. About Audio Monet. Audio Monet as in when I went to the Museum d'Orsay avec toi, je trouve ce cercle bleu. Okay, I haven't really. Anyway, so when I was in Paris, finally got over to Paris with the family, and I can remember looking at the Monet, the Impressionists, and seeing Monet's paintings for the first time. I was gobsmacked at the way the natural light popped into the building and the way it hit that the oil brushstroke painting, and the way it hit it and dispersed it and it went beyond the picture frame. It almost felt like the pond and the lilies and the willow tree or whatever it was actually went beyond the frame. And I always felt that. But you could have someone next to you prefer the Manet rather than the Monet. And it's just I think what I'm trying to say is, in fact, you can cut this out if you want. What I'm attempting to say
nothing's to be cut out. Keep going.
Okay.
It's impossible. I don't have the technology.
I'm walking the plank on this. All I'm trying to say is that all we can do as audio people, we're trying to recreate from an amplifier or speaker designer point of view, whatever it is, we're trying to trick the listener. We're sonic illusions. We're trying to trick the listener into thinking there's something live in the room, or a spooky presence,
absolutely,
a poltergeist, if you like, of what was recorded in the past. And it's an interpretation. So Richter might have a certain interpretation. I had a certain interpretation, and you have a certain interpretation. But one person might prefer the Manet. I can't remember any other impressionists. That's how well versed I am in it. But or Monet and
Manet there's another one on the tip of my tongue. I have a computer in front of me. You'd think I could press the keys, but keep going.
But my poorly expressed point is that all we're trying to do is trick the listener into thinking that's the sound that they remember when they've been to a concert or a live brass band or whatever. And it's just interpretation. So Ralph's interpretation was just as valid as mine or as yours, and it's just whether people switch on to one or the other. So, I don't know why
it's
like
that. It's impressionists, or it's wine, or it's, you know, it's any experience that some people, you know, cars, people prefer the way one drives to another. You know, it's humans, and some prefer one thing and some prefer another. I've been told that some people prefer giant Dodge Ram trucks for whatever reason to get around in, and others prefer, you know, other things. I'll just leave it at that. So,
I apologise for that.
There is a taste aspect to it, but I think clearly yourself and Ralph got on because you were in fact not competing at all. And you're both at different price points, different shaped speakers, but also a different take on the performance, the way they reproduce the performance.
Yeah, slightly different take, and but it's sort of worked for us, for both of us, with a lot of shops because different and different price point. I mean, in fact, we used to go to, say, Park Beach Hi-Fi and a few other stores. We traveled together to sort of cut the costs
and double the penetration. As far as, I mean, basically, one of you would obviously hold the owner of the store down, the other one locked the door, but then hang on, you'd be locking yourself in. Oh, I don't know, it doesn't work. Customers you can lock in, but yeah. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Delacorde loudspeakers, designed and manufactured in Australia. In fact, manufactured in their own facility in Brisbane. Three different models, three different flavours, and all built up to a standard, not down to a price. On demonstration now in hi-fi dealers across the country and available also direct. Have a look at delacorde.com.au.
Marvin Staff, and welcome back to the MCG. Yes, indeed. Marvin Staff, Australia, 2 for 22. And there's no doubt in my mind we're in a bit of trouble, but with the sort of buccaneering Cavalier Andrew Hutchison at the, the pitch, we'll be fine. Marvin Staff and fuck me. Oh, excuse me, I didn't mean to swear. And Bill Laurie's, of course, got the effing pigeons in here, and they've just shat on the beige and the cream sports coat that I like to don when I'm in the central commentary position. Can Bill... Anyway, enough of me being a fuckwit. Cut that shit out, mate. Sorry. Go ahead. Welcome back.
We'd mentioned Richter, and I will mention now that we will discuss that in a future episode. If you can talk to Ralph at some point, maybe once you can play him an episode and let him understand what's going on, he might be interested. So we'll just,
I think he would,
basically do a general wrap up. So I guess this is going to be episode one of the Not an Audiophile podcast. The gist of it being that the people on it are not audiophiles. Not that we're got it in for audiophiles, but it is, to me, it's an unfortunate term. But it's it seems to be quite popular these days. Everyone's an audiophile. But anyhow, we're not. I mean, well, we're not in the sense that the people, ourselves and other people that will be interviewed on the podcast, are not audiophiles, they're audio professionals. Which, yeah, kind of makes a change from the other people that do audio-related podcasts, I guess. We have a different perspective. They're not saying that it's better.
Oh, no. I would never say that.
It's different, and it comes from being, no. I guess, it comes from perhaps trying to make a living out of creating, repairing, designing, manufacturing, selling hi-fi equipment. So, yeah.
Yeah, that, it's from that perspective, if you like, and where would we be without audiophiles?
Life would clearly be simpler, but we can't say that.
Oh. Maybe. No. Oh, Andrew, curb and gutter. No, in a sense, we're coming from it. I suppose audiophiles are passionate about music, and there's some that are passionate about music and the equipment and the tweaking and the challenge of improving the system, and that's all part of the bloody fun. We love it.
Oh, yeah. So, and the reality is that... we clearly both love the technology and the equipment, the electronics, the engineering, what have you. That's absolutely part of it. But then I think for both of us, the music is probably what got us here in the first place. At least half of it, if not more. I think we'll call it quits at that. We'll be back. We've got more of the Brad/Orpheus story. There's obviously other things to talk about. There's many other people both of us know that will be interviewed in due course. So I would say to those that have made it this far that you can look forward to more of the same, if not a little bit better structured and organised, perhaps. But I've enjoyed it. I hope you have, Brad. Thank you for joining me. And we'll be back very soon.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. And Andrew, it's been a joy to... ride side saddle with you, if you like.
Sounding way I ride.
Of course. Giddy up.
All right.
Look forward to next time.
Talk to you next time. Thank you.
Cheers, mate. Thanks, guys. Bye.